Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast, where we're focused on the volunteer state with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Alex Nestor. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. It helps us and keeps this show free to you. And thanks for doing it. While you're there, a five-star review and comment is much appreciated by the algorithms that rank us. And you can write to me anytime at steve@mcview.us, and I just might read it on air. Okay, business done.
Organized, on message, and engaged with local officials so your voice is heard. We expose wrongdoing and extremism by investigating and shining a media spotlight on political indoctrination in your school. We help you file civil rights complaints, and when necessary, we'll take schools to court. Become a member and gain access to workshops, microgrants, webinars, events, and more. Our schools should encourage our kids' development into happy, resilient, free-thinking citizens, not members of identity groups indoctrinated in anger and resentment. Visit defendinged.org and join us in this urgent fight.
Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Ms. Alex Nestor. Parents Defending Education is a national grassroots organization working to reclaim our schools from activists imposing harmful agendas. Through network and coalition building, investigative reporting, litigation, and engagement on local, state, and national policies, we are fighting indoctrination in the classroom and promoting the restoration of a healthy, non-political education for our kids. We believe our children's education should be based on scholarship and facts and should nurture their development into the happy, resilient, free-thinking education citizens every democracy needs. Our classroom should include rigorous instruction in history, civics, literature, math, the sciences, and the ideas and values that enrich our country. Yet, in recent years, activists have targeted public, private, and charter schools across the country with a campaign to impose ideological-driven curriculum with a concerning and often divisive emphasis on students' group identities, race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, and gender. Many school districts and private schools have spent large sums of money on these efforts, and many more are preparing to do the same. This new educational mission is not only a war with basic American values, but also with childhood. Couched in vague slogans about social justice, the new curriculum divides our children into oppressor and oppressed groups. To one, it teaches guilt and shame. To the other, grievance and resentment. More broadly, throughout the school, it sows distrust, unhappiness, confusion, and fear. Schools are adopting this illiberal mission at the behest of a narrow group of activists, union leaders, and high-priced consultants without the consent of the students, parents, and communities whose interests the schools are supposed to serve. Those who dissent risk being called ugly names and shamed into silence. Alex Nestor is an investigative fellow for Parents Defending Education. Before joining Parents Defending Education, Alex reported on education at the Washington Free Beacon. Hello, Alex. How are you today?
Hi, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking, and thanks for all that you do.
Thanks for your kind introduction.
Oh, awesome. I'm glad I got it right. Took it right off your website. Your group, Parents Defending Education, says, if you want our schools to return to teaching our children all that they need to become the best version of themselves, to join you. We come from diverse races, religions, economic background, and political orientations, but we all agree that it is time to join together and stop this madness in our schools. How do you do it?
That is an excellent question. And you covered this a little bit in the introduction, but we do this in a variety of ways. First and foremost, and my favorite way of doing this is just by being involved with parents, by being with parents on the ground in their fight, by supporting them however we can, whether that's writing up its incident reports, which you can see on our indoctrination map on our website, or just by hearing them out and trying to provide them resources. And we have tons of those on our website, including, you know, what is Title IX, how to file a FOIA request, how can you, you know, write a letter to the editor for your local newspaper, all that kind of stuff. We try to provide that support for parents. Other things that we do include filing OCR complaints. That's complaints with the education department that often have to do with, well, OCR, civil rights issues in schools, which we're seeing a lot more of. As you mentioned, schools often are trying to divide kids along racial lines, which is discriminatory, that it goes against our constitution. So we have filed tons of OCR complaints to the education department there. We take up legal battles as well. And those are just a few ways I think that we fight this good fight.
And how did you get involved in PDE?
So as you mentioned, I was a reporter for the Washington Free Beacon, and Nikki Neely, who's the president and founder of Parents Defending Education, you know, she and PDE had sent me some stories to cover, some ideas for things. So that's how I first learned about PDE. And then, you know, I loved reporting and I didn't know that I would leave reporting or leave journalism so quickly, but the opportunity arose. And, you know, I'm very passionate about education as an issue. Both of my parents are teachers. So a lot of these conversations are ones that I've had around the dining room table since I was a little kid. So, you know, when I had the opportunity to kind of take the gloves off and actually, you know, fight a little bit more, if you will, that's, you know, I took that opportunity. That's how I got involved with PDE.
All right. And if someone donates to you, how is the money spent towards those ends?
Well, if in a few different ways. I mean, obviously, we all have to, you know, live and be housed and eat ourselves. But we really do try to be very conscious about, you know, the funds we receive from donors. Some of the things that we do can be pretty expensive. Our litigation work obviously can be expensive. Hiring lawyers, lawyers are not cheap. So that's, you know, one way that we spend our money. Another thing, something that I do a lot in my work, is file FOIA requests or public records requests. And unfortunately, these can cost money. You know, even though it's public information, you would think it would be readily available to the public. It is often not. And it often takes, you know, quite a process to ask for records, and they can be rather costly too. So those are a couple ways that we spend our money. We also do, I should mention too, we've in the past put on different conferences for parents. We had one in Virginia in 2021, which is the year we launched, and we invited a ton of speakers and a ton of parents here. And then last year in 2022, we spent the summer traveling to different states to, you know, again, provide more information and resources to parents there on the ground. So I guess those are a few of the different things that we do that take a little bit of money there.
Okay, that's great. It seems like your biggest opponents are the unions. You know, my dear friend Randy Weingarten, and even the private school associations like NAIS and Association of School Counselors. Do you have run-ins with these groups? And you said your parents were teachers. What did they ever tell you about the unions?
That's a great question. I think my mom would be a great person to have on your show because she has some words. But yeah, I mean, teachers unions, we do run into a lot of issues with them. And I mean, just think of teachers like my mom, right? They, until the Janus decision in 2018, you know, teachers were forced to pay into these unions. So for years, teachers unions, you know, were able to sort of build up this big pile of cash that now they're using on mainly, you know, Democratic campaigns. And just to note, Parents Defending Education is a nonpartisan organization, but we do know that teachers unions spend, I believe it's like close to 98% of their donations go to Democrats. And so that's one big way that they're spending money is on politicians that push policies that favor them. During COVID, when schools locked down, teachers unions were the ones that wanted to keep kids out of schools for months, if not over a year. They were the ones that said, kids would not be safe at school, even though that went against the science at the time. If they were to return to school, they were the ones that said that teachers need to be vaccinated and even kids need to be vaccinated before returning to school. So teachers' unions are a huge player here, and unfortunately, they have decades ahead of organizations like ours in building their infrastructure to push for the policies that they want to see in schools.
And they demanded a lot of money before opening for HVAC systems, which I have not seen many schools closed for the implementation of these HVAC systems. So all that money is sitting there somewhere, probably waiting for the next election in 2024. What champions have you found in DC that stand up to the unions?
So, I mean, are you saying organizations? There's an organization. I don't think they're based in DC, but the Freedom Foundation, they're a really good one. They're based in, if I'm not mistaken, Washington State. And they help to basically inform people about their rights post the Janus decision, because unfortunately, people who remain in unions oftentimes they might not know that they can opt essentially, I guess, opt out of their union. So the Freedom Foundation is a really good organization that fights on this. But if you're talking more of the policy side battles or policies of what we're seeing in schools or decisions that are being made, obviously we do that. Some of our organizations that we're friends with, like the Heritage Foundation, and the Alliance for Defending Freedom, also kind of do more on the policy level. That's, I guess, tangentially against the unions, but more so against the policies that they push. Does that help?
It does. That's a great answer. I was thinking more along the lines of elected politicians and their staffers who may be taking up your cause that you can work in, call in the middle of the night and say, hey, don't let them pass this or that. Any elected officials that are very close to your organization?
So, Parents Defending Education is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and as such, we don't lobby, we don't work with politicians on that side. On the PDE Action Front, that's a 501c4, so we have a more politically active arm. And on that side, we have worked with some lawmakers at the national level. Tim Scott is an amazing advocate for schools, for school choice, especially, which teachers unions hate, we know.
Senator from South Carolina, right?
I am not from South Carolina, no.
No, Tim Scott is. You're
Oh,
talking about
Tim
Tim
Scott is,
Scott? Yeah, he's the
yes, I'm
junior
sorry.
senator from South Carolina. Yeah.
Yes, he is. And he's wonderful. He's a great advocate for kids. And then the House Education and Labor Committee, we've worked with them in the past on some education related issues too. So there are advocates out here in DC in politics, that are fighting for families and for kids, certainly.
Good. So the Department of Education was run by Secretary Betsy DeVos for Trump's 4 years. And she, in her book, recommended shutting the department down. That's how bad it was. That would certainly give the responsibility back to the state lawmakers, with the unions not in charge so dramatically out of DC, centralized. Do you think the Department of Energy could close?
So I don't know if I want to say for sure if it could or whether or not it should. I think, I have my own personal views on that. I think also when you think of things like Title I funding and the amount of support that they give to kids in poverty, there's a very, important, I think, equal opportunity argument there. So I don't necessarily want to say that, yes, this should be shut down or whatnot, but it definitely needs some work. And I mean, you see right now with the Biden administration, the types of things that they're trying to push. The first thing that comes to mind is their whole rewrite of Title IX, which would essentially change the definition of sex as we know it from civil rights era laws to include gender identity. And this would essentially eliminate spaces for women in any publicly funded university or even K-12 schools. So that is a really big issue from the education department, from Biden's education department that we are seeing now. Is it possible that it's shut down? I mean, maybe. I sort of feel like we're kind of, I guess, past a point of they've sort of inserted themselves into so many different issues and areas, like I mentioned with the Title I funding. Obviously, we know that over time Congress has voted away a lot of their a jurisdiction given to them in the Constitution to large bureaucratic executive agencies. I would say the education department is one of them. So I don't want to give you a certain answer on that one.
Okay.
Well,
do you find that department to be helpful in your cause, especially when you're asking for freedom of information requests, or if you're going against a certain school board, let's say in a trial? Are they helpful, or do they throw up hurdles to make it harder for you to try to accomplish what your mission is?
I will say, in our experience, specifically with filing, I mentioned OCR complaints, and I should have been more specific and said what that acronym stands for. That's the Office of Civil Rights. And the Office of Civil Rights, they have to review every complaint that they receive. And they have reviewed the complaints that we have received. And in one case, one school in Massachusetts, after we filed a complaint against them, this was Wellesley Public Schools, they had to reverse course on a affinity group program that they had. And affinity groups basically separate kids by race, which is racist and unconstitutional. So that school had to shut down that program because of a complaint that we filed with the education department. So in some ways, they can be helpful because they're doing that job. When I was a reporter, I do recall I filed a public records request with the education department specifically for foreign funding into our public universities. I did receive that. It took probably a few months, almost close to a year, to get that back. But, you know, the education department is a lot of people, right? And there are going to be people in any government bureaucracy that just want to do their job and are helpful. And of course, there are going to be people who are, you know, political and see what our organization stands for and wants to go against that. So I personally, I don't want to say I've had an experience where I've had a specific education department staffer that's, you know, completely blocked anything or tried to be unhelpful. But it is a bureaucracy. It's a massive one. And right now it's run by a director that is, you know, against parental rights. So that, I guess that's my answer for you.
Okay. Yeah. As long as they behave professionally, I guess their political stuff can be put aside. But you did mention the civil rights, and I think that's a division of the Department of Justice, not the Department of Education. At least I hope there's not a civil rights of the Department of Education. So what about the FBI and DOJ charging moms and dads with domestic terrorism for speaking up at school board meetings? Is there attempt to scare opposition into silence working?
So there is an Office of Civil Rights within the Education Department. This is not currently headed up by Catherine Lehman, who was also the head under the Obama administration. But that's an interesting question as to the constitutionality of having an civil rights office within the Education Department. Obviously, its jurisdiction covers schools that receive federal funding. So I'll say that. But when it comes to trying to brand parents as domestic terrorists, I mean, yes, Parents Defending Education, we're the ones that uncovered those documents that showed explicitly that the National School Board Association and the White House had colluded essentially on this letter that called parents domestic terrorists. Thankfully, I haven't seen, and I hope there's nothing there from the Justice Department, the department that's actually going after parents. We haven't seen any issue. We haven't heard any issue from our advocates saying, hey, there was an FBI person, you know, in our public meeting. Now, I'm not sure when it comes to maybe monitoring parent groups, that could be something. I mean, the FBI investigates domestic terrorist threats, so perhaps that is something that they're doing, but we have not seen anything to show right now that there is some sort of active investigation into any individual parent group.
That was you that discovered the memo, but now you think the memo, maybe because it was disclosed, they haven't acted on it and it kind of went away as a tactic for the time being.
Or if they are acting on it, we haven't seen any specific example.
Okay. And they haven't hindered you at all.
No.
Good. Okay. Well, a lot of schools had to take COVID bailout money to stay open. In Washington, where Steve, the producer, is, they're closing schools because thousands didn't come back to school this year. And those Fed funds didn't show up because each kid, each head is worth X amount of dollars to federal funds. And if they're not there, the money's not there. Are charters and private schools picking these kids up, or are they just dropping out?
So that's a really good question. We do know that about a million public schools across the United States lost about a million kids during the pandemic. And from the increase that we see in homeschooling, private schooling, and charter school numbers, that it from what I've seen, the numbers in homeschooling, private, and charter schools haven't exactly equaled that 1 million student loss in public schools. So yes, private charter homeschooling is increasing. I know my dad taught at a charter school in Florida that had a wait list of over 1,000 students on it. So yeah, I mean, private schools, charter school enrollment definitely going up right now. But it is a bit concerning to me that public schools have lost a million students and not all of those students are accounted for. I think that's really shameful that we don't know where some of these kids are.
If they did go to homeschooling, would they be in the numbers? I mean, I know if they went to public school, they have to sign in. And if they go to private schools, same type of thing. There's records of that. If it was private, if it was homeschooling, would it be as clear?
That's a good question. And I'm not entirely sure of the answer. Again, I'm just going off of reports that have said that there's still some difference between the enrollment increase we're seeing in private charter homeschool versus the enrollment decrease we're seeing in public school. But I would think that that might be a little more challenging to track. And probably it differs by state as to how that is tracked.
Mm-hmm. And do you think woke ideology chased them away, or would it be violence in the classroom or parents moving them out of state? What do you think it is, the majority of kids not coming back?
I think the answer is D, all of the above. I mean, first and foremost, again, bringing it back to sort of what started this whole, parental involvement in education issue in 2020. Parents were upset because their kids were shut out of classrooms and they saw the devastating impacts on the mental health and academic performance of their kids. So that was first and foremost. And I think parents oftentimes moved parents, if they had the resources, would move their child either out of state to a different school, to a private school or a charter school, if their public school was closed for, you know, what they thought was too long. So I would say school closures, first and foremost, was, you know, one of the biggest reasons parents started moving their kids out of public schools and into other options. But definitely, I mean, I think the race ideology plays into it. I think the gender ideology plays into it. And I think, the umbrella, I guess, of those two issues is parental rights and parental involvement. Parents are being shut out of decisions and conversations about these issues, right? We see district after district after district pass policies that explicitly say that parents may not be notified if their child decides to live as the opposite sex at school. That is unconscionable, and parents are getting absolutely fed up with being made out to be the villains here. So I do think between school closures, race and gender ideology we're seeing in school. And you mentioned the behavior issue too. That is a huge one. Kids are not behaving in the classroom. Teachers do not have control over their kids. And I'm sure that's another reason why parents are considering other options for their kids.
Have you seen any research yet that say that the parents who have made the decision to leave the public schools for something else, like a charter, like a private school, have found the grass greener? Are they happy with that decision, or are they just waiting for their school to open back up to send them back to the free romper room daycare, you know, that the governments give us as a right? Have you seen any statistics on that, if they made the right choice and are happy with it?
I haven't seen anything specific on that per se, but I will say, I don't know if we're seeing public school enrollment numbers go back up, at least not to the rate that we saw before the pandemic. And also, in terms of satisfaction, are parents satisfied with the education that their kids are getting? I'll give you this. On the National Assessment of Educational Progress test in 2020, this is a test that measures fourth and eighth grade reading and math. If you look at the performance of Catholic schools versus every other state, Catholic schools would be performing as the best state in the country on those assessments. Whereas, you know, nationally, scores fell, Catholic schools outperformed excuse me, in reading and math, at fourth and eighth grade reading and math, outperformed every state there. And that was a big option that parents went to instead of their public school. So I would say that's one indicator that parents are probably happy with taking their kids out of school if they sent them to a Catholic school. But I would also say that the lack of, bounce back in enrollment for public school numbers also shows that parents are probably happier with their other options.
Yeah, and putting a little bit of God back into the kids' classroom can't be a bad thing either. Moms for Liberty has been on the show a few times. Both our Williamson County president and founder and the national, Tiffany Justice. You have very similar missions. They were pretty successful last November with school boards and supervisor elections. How successful have you been in those elections?
So again, Parents Defending Education as a 501c3, we don't get involved in elections. On the C4 side, we have a team of about six people. We at the moment are not getting involved in school board elections because it is so hard on a national level to vet so many people. There are 13,500 school districts across the United States, and only six of us. So I don't think we're the best suited to do that at the moment. But organizations like Moms for Liberty, they have different chapters, and they're much more in tuned on the ground. They know what issues are, in their district. They know the people, they know the community, they know the school board members, the current school board members. They know, different candidates or potential candidates. So I think Moms for Liberty, and I'm so glad to hear that you've had them on your show. Organizations like those that have local chapters, we think are much better suited because education is such a local issue. It happens at the local level. And of course, we like to help as much as we can from the national level, but it's better suited for people who know their communities better to get involved in those types of races.
Yeah. And so you have a website, and on your website, there is a filter where you can basically look at your state or your county to see what recent offenses have taken place in the public schools or whatnot. And so I just picked out a couple here because this is a Tennessee podcast. In July of 2022, the Hamilton County Commission voted to appropriate $70,000 to Caleb Fund to address discipline disparities and restorative justice practices in Hamilton County. Hamilton County School District teachers went through white privilege training. The lessons included people of color cannot be racist, and white privilege is both a legacy, a cause of racism. I don't know what that means. Both a legacy and a cause of racism. According to board member Rhonda Thurman, teachers who had to sit through this are furious. What does your organization do once they find out information like that, besides post the news?
Yeah. Well, I mean, posting it we think is really important. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. We also like to get it out in the media. I mean, we like to tell podcasts, radio shows, news outlets like Fox News as much as we can put this on blast. I think that's so important because it is important in this case. You said it was a training for teachers. It's so important that those teachers' voices are heard, or that, for our other incidents, that parents' voices are heard. So, I mean, that's step one. Step two, I think, is sort of getting involved in, like I've mentioned, we have tons of different resources on our website, even information that explains sort of legally your First Amendment rights, your Title IX rights, or what have you. We like to send those to teachers there. And then, we have a team of lawyers. If we think it might warrant it, we have lawyers review the facts of the case and state law and see maybe if there's something there that we can or should get involved legally over. So those are a few different things that we do when cases arise like this. But I don't think that you can overstate the importance of just getting the information out there. Not only, like I said, for parents and teachers on the ground so that their voices are heard, but also across the country or across the state. It would be really interesting for maybe a parent in an adjacent county to say, "Oh my gosh, look what's going on in Hamilton." So getting out the information, I think, is a amazing and very important first step there.
Sure, especially as a researcher, since you're doing the research, you want people to know about it. Here's another one. Wilson County Schools is in the process of approving a new contract with Panorama Education for the 2022-23 school year. That's now. Parents Defending Education received the contract from a concerned community member. If the contract is approved, the school district will pay Panorama a total of $179,700 for 1 year of service. This is split into $176,700 for the annual license fee and $3,000 for professional development. The contract includes climate surveys for students to help implement social emotional learning. What can you tell us about that contract with Panorama and social emotional learning?
So I'm really glad that you brought this up, because social emotional learning is sort of just one more way or method that activists are trying to push race and gender ideology on our kids. And they're doing so in a way that to me is pretty nefarious, because it's kind of done under the cover of something that sounds really nice. Social emotional learning sounds nice. Making sure kids feel safe and welcome in their schools sounds nice. But what Panorama Education does, and this is an organization that was founded by Merrick Garland, who is the attorney general, his son-in-law. This is an organization that surveys kids and has asked kids very personal questions, about their feelings of safety and acceptance at home and at school based on their race, their sexual orientation, and their gender identity. These are very personal questions. There have been cases in which parents do not know that their kids are being asked these types of questions. And again, this is all done under the guise of social emotional learning, which sounds like a great thing, especially after the pandemic when kids were shut out of classrooms. And we know that there's a mental health crisis in our country. This is apparently supposed to be the end all be all cure for kids. And honestly, what it does more than anything is it collects personal data on children. And, I don't know who exactly they share it with, but new studies have shown that a lot of the sort of apps or websites that schools use are not really great with the whole data privacy thing. So to think that kids are being asked this information, it's being saved somewhere, and that it could potentially be shared outside is just unfathomable, especially when parents aren't included in that decision. And quickly, sorry, I'm going on a bit here. Social emotional learning is, again, it's like this mental health kind of focus for kids. It really transformed in 2020. And we all had a form of social emotional learning growing up. We called it soft skills, right? It was learning how to cooperate with other kids. It was learning how to behave in a classroom. But now, unfortunately, after this whole transformative push post 2020, it really means more about, am I an oppressor because I'm white, or am I a victim because I'm black? How does that impact, school and whatnot? So it has taken a pretty radical turn to focus on race and gender ideology. So that's a bit about Panorama Education. And we have a whole consultant report card on our website that dives deeper into Panorama Education. We also have more information on social emotional learning if any of your listeners want to take a deep dive on that.
And I had to take a double take, because I would have thought the numbers would be upside down. $3,000 only for professional development, $179,000 for 1 year of service is a heck of a retainer, but okay. One more, and then hopefully we don't run out of time with you. Harpeth Hall is an elite all-girls school for grades 5 through 12 in Nashville. I can see it pretty much out my window here. According to its website, is working in tandem with equity consultant Nicole Furlong of the Klingenstein Center at Columbia University. All right, that's a New York university. The Klingenstein Center is part of Columbia Teachers College, an organization that creates resources and trains teachers in critical race theory and gender ideology. Furlong currently serves on the board of the Center for Transformative Teaching and Learning. Dr. Furlong's research examines the intersections between listening, cognitive neuroscience, social justice, and school leadership. She lives in Yonkers, New York. CTTL's priority is to ensure that 100% preschool through 12th grade teachers receive training and ongoing professional development every school year in mind, brain, and education service. The CTTL shares its mission-driven public purpose and desire to support teachers as exemplars in their use of MBE research-informed strategies. More than 10,000 teachers, school leaders, and policymakers have read the CTTL's publication, Think Differently and Deeply, 4 volumes, which provide models for how teachers can use research to inform the design of their classes and to work more effectively with each student. One such study says, as we grow to understand our own identities and the lived experiences we bring to our classrooms, schools, and other learning environments, we create space to deepen our understanding of our students that affords us the opportunities to strengthen those relationships. We can also use the braid to reflect on our own identities. Alex, what does this have to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic?
Short answer is nothing. Long answer is, this is a question, or I guess my answer is going to be an answer to a question we're often asked, is how does the race and gender ideology get into our schools in the first place? And a lot of it has to do with what teachers are taught in graduate school. This is a story that I did for the Free Beacon, gosh, a long time ago now. But basically, a lot of the top education schools include classes specifically on Marx and his sort of followers, his ilk. And I don't mean to get too in the weeds on this, but he's basically the one that started this whole oppressor versus oppressed narrative, right? So this is stuff that they are learning in their graduate school programs, and therefore it sort of, you know, trickles into the classroom. And even more than that, it frames everything that they teach, from math to science to history to reading. It is all about this lens of oppressor versus oppressed. And this is a great example of that. So it's a lot of it's coming in through teachers. And you're right, none of it has to do with, oh, hey, what's the best way to teach reading, or what's the best way to teach math, or how do we get kids who might be behind in these areas, you know, to advance or whatnot. It's not about that. It's a lot about the, you know, political sort of indoctrination there.
Okay, one more local story. I had to get your opinion on this. St. Mary's Episcopal School in Memphis, which we just heard a lot about in the news, promotes affinity groups for students on its website. Affinity groups are groups that segregate people, branded diversity, equity, and inclusion, although it sounds like it does not include. Students in seventh grade must choose two books from a list to read from during the summer. One book on the list is stamped Racism, Anti-Racism, and You by known political activist Ibram X. Kendi and Jason Reynolds. The book is known to promote racial equity and tenets of critical race theory as ways to deal with perceived oppression. The list also features another book from Jason Reynolds titled The Boy in the Black Suit. These books aren't I as in inclusive or D as in divisive diversity, but D as in divisive. That's what you're fighting against, right?
That's exactly right. And again, something like anti-racism sounds great because no one wants to be racist. But really, this book, especially Stamped, which is by Ibram X. Kendi, who's the main anti-racist activist that we've, you know, seen been popularized over the past few years. You know, it teaches that we are separate. It teaches that some people are victims and some people are oppressors, and that couldn't be any more divisive. And look, we can learn about our nation's history. I think it's so important to read about all parts of our past, including bad ones, including like Japanese internment and slavery and what have you. It is important that we know these facts, absolutely. But it's also important to know that we as a country were set out as, you know, an experiment. And every year, every day, we live up to the ideals set out in our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, more and more every day. And we should celebrate that and not, you know, think that our principles are somehow flawed because of flawed people that have failed to live them out in the past. I think that is such an important idea that we need to revisit and come back to, instead of just teaching kids that they're separate and not equal.
And all those stories come from your website at Parents Defending Education, your indoctrination map. Those are just Tennessee. You can go there and see all the states and all of the stories that are making news that you probably won't agree with, listener. They are the worst in every state. It's like an explosion across the country and really not slowing down. Do you see the solutions? Are there any solutions?
That is the million-dollar question, right? I think there are different types of solutions, right? I think one, exposing, maybe that's not a full solution, but again, it's getting the information out there. I think too, look, the most important people that you vote for are the people that pass policies that impact you the most, and those are local people. So again, I'm not, you know, saying that you should vote for X or Y person, but get involved in your know who's running in your local election for your school board, for your state board of education, if you're in a state where that board is elected. Those things are so important. And also just know what your kid is being taught in school. I know parents are super busy. Again, my parents are both teachers. They both had full-time jobs. But, you know, it's important to know, hey, what books are your kids learning as part of their reading class? You know, what kind of math assignments are they getting? Just really be involved in your community, in your kids' life. And honestly, I think that's how we're going to make the most change going forward. Yeah, and I would also just say to continue to have hope. Like you said, we're still seeing tons of incident reports, but we also have a lot of little victories, and we should celebrate those and, you know, not get discouraged. It's going to be a long fight, but we're here for the fight. We're here for the parents that are in the fight. And if parents ever need some support, you can find, you know, find us and reach out to us on our website at defendinged.org.
Okay, I got time for a few more questions. Just want to get through these. In Tennessee, Republicans ran on school choice when they won the majority 10 years ago, after many years of Democrats running the state. Even Bill Lee ran on a 10 for 10, T-E-N-N, platform that included school choice. I don't see they've done much, including blocking charters. It's not a Dem-Republican issue when an entire generation, kids that were 6 and are now 16, lose all that learning. I hope you're right and we can fix it, but Randy will still be there. She just got reelected, I think by 105%, some kind of Saddam Hussein type numbers, not counting the absentees from Ukraine. How has the media treated your group?
That's a really interesting question. Look, again, we're a nonpartisan organization. We have members, I have colleagues who, you know, voted for all different parties throughout, you know, their lives and careers and whatnot. So it's interesting the type of coverage that we get, because I think a lot of times that we're perceived one way or another just because we fight for parental rights. Some outlets are more favorable than others, for sure. So it's a mixed bag. But look, I mean, I don't view the media as being necessarily fair, and we can take the punches.
Okay. So Nicole Neely, I think I said that right, is the president and founder of Parents Defending Education, right? She's also the president of Speech First, a national campus free speech organization, and has worked at the Independent Women's Forum and the Cato Institute. The vision of the Cato Institute is to create free, open, and civil societies founded on libertarian principles. Cato has called for the regulation of technology to protect kids and teens. TikTok, Facebook, Instagram seem harmful to these kids, but schools rely on those, and YouTube, where the temptation to click a pop-up on transgenderism or LGBT or pornography or violent content is pushed, another tsunami of dark stuff kids have to deal with. What do you think of tech and internet in schools? And then I have one last question for you.
Yeah, it's a really interesting and sort of new thing that we're seeing. Increasingly, not only are kids on social media, but teachers are encouraging kids to use social media. I believe you mentioned teachers encouraging kids to use TikTok as part of their classroom assignments. And there are like two main issues that I see here. First and foremost, we know, especially on girls, the impact that social media has on their self-esteem. And we know that Facebook and Instagram, which I believe is owned by Facebook now, has hidden information about hidden knowledge, like what they knew about that impact that it's had on girls over the past few years, which is a very negative one. So there's that element of things, the mental health impacts of social media usage, but there's also the data and privacy issues. And especially with TikTok, we know that TikTok is a national security threat, and it is being banned in multiple states for that reason. This is something that former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, I believe, right before the change in administration. This is something that's well documented. TikTok is a national security threat. And yet we're seeing teachers want to push this and use this in schools. In addition to that, we also know that there's just massive data privacy threats. I noted that when we were talking about Panorama Education, that other third-party apps that teachers and administrators use in schools, either for classroom lessons or communicating with parents, what have you. A lot of these technologies don't really have good policies for data sharing. And, you know, the effects of that could be, this was reported actually in the 74 million, I believe, in January. But a lot of these have sort of a situation where they give students data to third parties, like third party marketing firms that can then make student profiles and target kids with ads. So that seems a little odd and unsafe that schools are sort of putting kids at risk in that way. And then we have the issue of cybersecurity and hackers. This happened in Broward County. This happened in a couple districts in Iowa in the past few years, where hackers have gotten into the schools' computer systems and have sort of held kids' data hostage for, you know, massive ransom payments. So there are, again, sorry, that was kind of lengthy, but a few different issues with the increase.
It's dangerous out there, no question about it. We're going to need a HIPAA Act for education, K through 12. Okay, last question. If you had kids, would you want them in public school today? Maybe you do have kids, but I'm guessing you might want to have an opinion on that at least.
I don't have kids. Look, schools are very, you know, local. There are still great public schools out there. My mom is a public school teacher. A lot of my aunts and uncles were. So if my kids were being taught, my future kids are being taught by people like my mom, absolutely, I'd send them to public schools. But that looks increasingly unlikely. But I've got a few years to decide.
Okay. Well, hopefully we can fix it all by then. So Alex, thank you for your time. We really appreciate you. We are at the end here. Please tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you and Parents Defending Education.
You can find us at defendinged.org.
Okay. Thanks again for coming on with us.
Thank you. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you. I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand how I bring you down to your... Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what do you think of our guest, Ms. Alex Nestor?
Well, I made a lot of comments on something, but I know you've got a lot to share. But thank you for bringing another wonderful guest on, and to know that there's organizations and individuals like her that are on fire to try to help and come in and shine a light on the darkness and expose what's going on in our modern day public system, public education system. And, you know, she talked about soft skills. When I was a kid, that was called getting beat up or defending oneself. But we didn't have soft skills. I learned that when I went to my kids' elementary school and they had no bullying and all these signs on the wall and everything. I thought, well, that's kind of cool compared to what I survived. But on the other hand, then they did the dumbing down thing that Bush was under, or Obama, for Common Core. Oh my gosh, we've got to make sure that our kids getting supplemented at home. So.
And the bullies became the administrators and the superintendents and the textbook writers, unfortunately.
You nailed it.
Some tragic news on a Valentine's Day. The International Olympic Committee in Lausanne, Switzerland, studied documents from international data banks from 1966 to 2004. That's a pretty long subset. Those documents indicate 1,101 sudden deaths in athletes under 35 years of age, an average of 29 athletes per year, the sports with the highest incident being soccer and basketball. In prior years, there were 66 deaths per year, but there have been 89 reported in January of this year alone. Let's play clip number one.
There's not a whole lot of people wearing masks. So I want to ask you specifically, can you define for people what the role of masks is? And why were we told to wait? Why were we told later in the spring to wear them when we initially were told not to?
Okay, that's a good question. And I'm glad that you asked and to give me the opportunity to clarify it. So let's start with your first question. You know, Masks are not 100% protective. However, they certainly are better than not wearing a mask, both to prevent you, if you happen to be a person who maybe feels well but has an asymptomatic infection that you don't even know about, to prevent you from infecting someone else. But also, it can protect to a certain degree, not 100%, in protecting you from getting infected from someone who either is breathing or coughing or sneezing or singing or whatever it is in which the droplets or the aerosols go out.
So, as you know, 2 weeks ago, Vashon Island, out where you live, put kids back in masks for 2 weeks. Per goodsciencing.com, 1,712 athlete cardiac arrests or serious issues, 1,208 of them dead, 70% since COVID injection, up from 66. Okay, not normal. Per lawyer from Ohio, Tom Renz, there is no discussion. mRNA is a gene therapy product, and the only reason anyone is questioning this is because Big Pharma paid off enough scientists to lie about this being a question. Pfizer, Moderna, and many other Big Pharma gangsters have acknowledged this is the past, but Google has done everything possible to scrub it from the internet. While I have an immense amount of documentation on this from various sources, I'm going to focus this article on a single Moderna document that I think provides enough evidence on its own to end the dispute, which would not even exist if the corrupt media and fact checkers were not bought off by the same money as the corrupt scientists. There is zero question that these jabs are and were always a gene therapy, despite a corrupt media and a bunch of bought-off scientists changing their tune after receiving big checks. Moderna explicitly acknowledged this fact. Pfizer and others have done the same in other paperwork I have. If you received these shots thinking they were vaccines, you were lied to. It is just that simple, and the problems you are will have from them are a direct result of what happens to have been an incredibly complex and corrupt plan to push this new and untested category of drugs onto the global public, regardless of the cost to life and safety. Tom Renz, he's a lawyer, sue him. Clip number two.
Fauci.
I am Kizzmekia Corbett.
My name's Vivek Murthy.
I'm the chief medical advisor on COVID-19 to President Joe Biden.
I and my team helped to invent and develop the COVID-19 vaccine.
I'm the United States Surgeon General.
We are here to answer your questions about the COVID-19 vaccine.
Hi, Dr. Fauci. How do we know it is safe for full vaccine people to not wear their masks indoor and outdoor?
The decision that we don't have to wear masks when you're fully vaccinated is really based on an accumulation of scientific evidence over the past several weeks. The low level of infection in the community and the extraordinarily high effectiveness of the vaccine has brought us to the conclusion that it is now safe to put aside masks so long as you are vaccinated.
God, I want to shoot that guy so bad.
Well, we've learned a lot since then, haven't we? Let's play clip number three.
Guidance on the way from the CDC, expected to come as soon as next week as states drop their mandates. Whit Johnson joins us now with more on the battle over masks. Good morning, Whit.
Michael, good morning. The CDC director says she wants to give people a break from wearing masks when the metrics get better. Not just the number of daily COVID infections in this country, but key factors like hospital capacity. That new guidance is coming soon as more states move ahead on their own.
This morning, with indoor mask mandates remaining in just a handful of states, the CDC expected to announce new mask guidance as early as next week.
We must consider hospital capacity as an additional important barometer. Our hospitals need to be able to take care of people with heart attacks and strokes.
10 states are still running low on ICU beds with capacity of 15% or less, despite cases plunging more than 80% since the Omicron peak. The White House insisting it's actively planning for the next phase of the pandemic.
We've been clear that as a country, we're making strong progress toward moving to a time when COVID is no longer a crisis.
California, the latest state to drop its indoor mask mandate, but among at least a dozen states where masks are still required in school.
Enough, Steve. Enough.
Yeah, I know, but I want to talk about masks. I still see them on faces and on kids out there.
Every day. I've got a couple guys in my office complex. I see them in the hall,
And
filthy, bacteria-soaked, microfiber-inhaling surgical masks from China. The CDC still recommends masks for all people in areas of the U.S. that are deemed high risk and for anyone who is immunocompromised or unvaccinated. A major new study shows that masks don't stop the spread of COVID. Will the mandators apologize? By Timothy P. Carney, senior columnist, Washington Examiner, February 2nd, 2023, last week. A dozen scientists from around the world conducted a massive meta study of our efforts to fight COVID as well as similar efforts to fight the flu, and they published the results in the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews. So that's serious. The authors examined 78 different studies on the efficacy of different mitigation efforts such as masking, distancing, screening, quarantining, and hand washing. Okay, again, meta study, a study of 78 studies. They were all randomized controlled trials or at least cluster RCTs. These are the gold standard for studies because they have the greatest chance of avoiding confounding factors. Here's the most eye-opening finding. Wearing masks in the community probably makes little or no difference to the outcome of influenza-like illness, COVID-19-like illness, compared to not wearing masks. In other words, masks didn't do much, if anything. It's possible that a community could drive down spread if everyone wore well-fitted, high-quality masks such as N95s or respirators, but there is no conclusive evidence that it does. With that in mind, I think back to late 2020s to mid-2022, when mayors, governors, school districts, and even the U.S. Department of Transportation and Joe Biden were forcing masks on unwilling people, especially children, even when viral transmission was very low. Early on, when public health officials told us to wear masks, they were simply playing it safe. But as time went on, even as the efficacy of masks became more doubtful, the officials switched from asking to mandating. They went beyond mandating, of course, and attacked everyone who resisted their mandates as selfish grandma killers. The mayors and county executives who required masks knew they didn't work, obviously, because these same mayors and county executives personally refused to wear these masks in exactly the situations where they were mandating the masks.
That's right.
Did Jay Inslee do that?
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did. Clip number four, please.
The question I ask is how many kids are dying and how many kids are going to the hospital who've already had COVID? The answer may be zero, but you're not even giving us the data because you have so much wanted to protect everybody from all the data because we're not smart enough to look at the data. When you released data earlier, when the CDC released the data, they left out the category of 18 to 49 on whether or not there was a health benefit for adults 18 to 49. Why was it left out? When critics finally complained, it was finally included because there was no health benefit from taking a booster between the 18 to 49 and the CDC study. Another question for you. The NIH continues to refuse to voluntarily divulge the names of scientists who receive royalties and from which companies. Over the period of time from 2010 to 2016, 27,000 royalty payments were paid to 1,800 NIH employees. We know that, not because you told us, but because we forced you to tell us through the Freedom of Information Act. Over $193 million was given to these 1,800 employees. Can you tell me that you have not received a royalty from any entity that you ever oversaw the distribution of money in research grants?
Well, first of all, let's talk about royalty.
That's the question. No, that's the question. Have you ever overseen, Senator, have you ever received a royalty payment from a company that you later oversaw money going to that company?
You know, I don't know as a fact, but I doubt it.
Well, here's the thing is, why don't you let us know? Why don't you reveal how much you've gotten and from what entities? The NIH refuses. Look, we ask them. The NIH, we ask them whether or not, who got it and how much. They refuse to tell us. They sent it redacted. Here's what I want to know. It's not just about you. Everybody on the vaccine committee, have any of them ever received money from the people who make vaccines? Right. Can you tell me that? Can you tell me if anybody on the vaccine approval committees ever received any money from people who make vaccines?
Are you going to let me answer a question? Soundbite number one, are you going to let me answer a question? Okay, so let me give you some information. First of all, according to the regulations, people who receive royalties are not required to divulge them, even on their financial statement, according to the Bayh-Dole Act. So let me-
Yep, corrupt to the core allows this to go on, Steve.
So that was Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, just a little north of here. I could probably throw a Louisville slugger that far. And Dr. Fauci, of course, going at it, the odd couple of the pandemic. Let's go with clip number 5, and then I got something to say.
Dr. Fauci, knowing that it is a crime to lie to Congress, do you wish to retract your statement of May 11th where you claimed that the NIH never funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan?
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress.
Microphone down. Your microphone.
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress, and I do not retract that statement. This paper that you are referring to was judged by qualified staff up and down the chain as not being gain of function.
You take an animal virus and you increase its transmissibility to humans, right. You're saying that's not gain of function?
Yeah, that is correct. And Senator Paul, you do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say that officially. You do not know what you are talking about.
Let's read from the NIH definition of gain of function. This is your definition that you guys wrote. It says that scientific research that increases the transmissibility among mammals is gain of function. They took animal viruses that only occur in animals, and they increased their transmissibility to humans. How you can say that is not gain of function?
It is not.
It's a dance, and you're dancing around this because you're trying to obscure responsibility for 4 million people dying around the world from a...
Well, I think you got him. We'll see how this goes. The CDC is still recommending masking in areas with high transmission levels, fewer than 4% of U.S. counties, as well as indoor masking to protect high-risk contacts in medium counties, 27%. Masks are still required in educational institutions and democratic strongholds such as New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Washington, and California,
medical.
According to the Daily Mail.
Yep, medical. If you go to the medical clinic, any kind of clinic, you have to wear a mask.
Did you look ahead in my script? Boston Public Schools denied it temporarily masking protocol in early January was a mandate following a public letter against the policy by student Enrique, whatever his name is, while the Department of Health and Human Services fact sheet on N95 says they can filter particles under 0.3 microns, which can include SARS-CoV-2. Mansell said they aren't rated to capture matter below that threshold. The sheet also warns N95s can filter gases and vapors, which include aerosolized COVID, and N95 maker Honeywell sets the minimum at 0.3 microns as well, she said. More than 90% of exhaled particles have been shown to fall under 0.3 microns. Like I've said since the beginning, masks are like trying to catch a mosquito with a chain link fence. Impossible. Clip number 6.
The point that you are making is that the grant that was funded as a subaward from EcoHealth to Wuhan created SARS-CoV-2. That's where you are getting. Let me finish.
We don't know.
Well,
we don't
wait
know
a minute.
If it did
I
come
can,
from the lab, but all you, the evidence is pointing that it came from the lab,
you,
and there will be responsibility for those who funded the lab, including yourself.
I totally
This committee
resent,
will allow the witness to respond.
I totally resent the lie that you are now propagating, Senator. Those viruses are molecularly impossible
no one's
to result
they are. No
in SARS-CoV-2
pandemic.
Paul,
we're saying they are gain-of-function viruses because they were animal viruses that became more transmissible in human, and you funded it.
And you
admit the truth.
And you implying...
Senator Paul, your time has expired, and I will allow witnesses who come before this committee to respond.
You are implying that what we did was responsible for the deaths of individuals. I totally resent
and it could
that.
Have been.
And if anybody
and it could
is lying
been.
Here, Senator, it is you.
It is not you. It is you, Mr. Fauci. Now, someone named Kevin Bass, MSMD, PhD student, medical school in Newsweek, of all places, wrote, Newsweek is not part of the vast right-wing conspiracy. It's time for the scientific community to admit we were wrong about COVID and it cost lives. Sounds good, right? As a medical student and researcher, I staunchly supported the efforts of the public health authorities when it came to COVID-19. I believe that the authorities responded to the largest public health crisis of our lives with compassion, diligence, and scientific expertise. I was with them when they called for lockdowns, vaccines, and boosters. I was wrong. We in the scientific community were wrong, and it cost lives. I can see now that the scientific community, from the CDC to the WHO to the FDA and their representatives, repeatedly overstated the evidence and misled the public about its own views and policies, including on natural versus artificial immunity, school closures and disease transmission, aerosol spread, mask mandates, and vaccine effectiveness and safety, especially among the young. All of these were scientific mistakes at the time, not in hindsight. Amazingly, some of these obfuscations continue to the present day. So Dr. Pierre Corey, that frequently guest writes for my newspaper, MillCreekViewOnline.com, saw that Article 2 and had this to say: although I have been describing myself of late as an expert in spotting COVID disinformation and propaganda tactics, this week I discovered that I, along with many others, got fooled by the above Newsweek article, naively thinking it is a representative of the genuine reflecting of a bold medical student. A Midwestern doctor saw the article for exactly what it was, yet another lame attempt at a plea for amnesty by those in power.
Yes, that's so, what it is.
What?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
All right. So what did a Midwestern doc say in his Forgotten Side of Medicine Substack? If you look at this article within the context of Oster's previous plea and its response, both of these articles are essentially trying to do the same thing. I believe a strong case can be made that these were tests to see what narratives needed to be pivoted to. Likewise, Germany's Minister of Health and a well-credentialed scientist finally made a limited apology for the disastrous policies he pushed on the German people without knowingly the worst mistake, while simultaneously shifting the blame for his decisions to unnamed scientists who gave him bad advice. Any type of promise or apology, especially disingenuous ones, will not prevent what we saw happen over the last few years from happening again. Laws and ideally constitutional amendments, initially at the state level and ideally at the national level, can prevent such tragedies, and many people I have spoken to feel we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to correct many of the systemic issues within medicine that have poisoned our culture. In my own opinion, if these people are actually sorry for what they did to us, they would be willing to relinquish some of their power so it would not happen again, and I believe moving forward, it is critical for us to hold them to that. Anything less should not be considered acceptable for them to be granted amnesty. Clip number 7.
This time last week, we were baffled by the idea that in America, there were people who were talking about wearing not one, but two masks to take on coronavirus. You may remember this from way back when. Well, back then, all and sundry were telling you that this was the thing to do. In fact, even the New York Times was going out of its way to tell people that two masks are the new masks. And then there was some statements that were made by Dr. Anthony Fauci, of course, the all-to-do expert about these things, where he said that, the double masking made sense. That made news. It was even suggested that he would end up making it the formal policy of the United States. Well, fast forward a week later, and the man who must be obeyed now says this. That's the exactly opposite thing that he said this time last week about double bagging to beat the Wu flu.
There are many people who feel, if you really want to have an extra little bit of protection, maybe I should put two masks on. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's no data that indicates that that is going to make a difference.
So this week, about the two masks. Last week, it's a good idea. And then way back at the start of the pandemic, he was telling Americans this.
When you're in the middle of an outbreak, wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better, and it might even block a droplet, but it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is. And often, there are unintended consequences. People keep fiddling with the mask and they keep touching their face.
No wonder some people were slightly confused about what to do or not to do, or to do then not to do in the United States.
Another report, bear with me. Post-COVID-19, still wear a face mask? Self-perceived facial attractiveness reduces mask-wearing intention. was derived from three studies conducted by the Department of Psychology and Center for Happiness Studies at Seoul National University in South Korea. The first two studies found that people who thought they were good-looking were less willing to wear a mask. They were less likely to believe that mask wearing made them look better. The third study found that their belief was stronger in situations where they needed to deliver a favorable impression. Research shows that individuals who perceive themselves as more versus less attractive possess more socially desirable attributes, have higher self-esteem, and enjoy better mental and physical health, the study stated. The Daily Mail reported that the people examined in the study were American recruited from Amazon Mechanical Turk, and the average age of those in the study were 33 years old. According to the Ipso report from early December, roughly half of the Americans they surveyed reported wearing masks at all times or sometimes when on an airplane. 39% of respondents said they wore masks at all times or sometimes when on public transportation or in a rideshare. 33% said they wore masks at all times or sometimes in grocery stores. 85% of respondents said that the COVID-19 virus would not go away during their lifetimes. Chris Queen at PJ Media has a theory about people using masks as a sort of barrier between themselves and others. Our findings suggest that the mask wearing can shift from being a self-protection measure during the COVID-19 pandemic to a self-presentation tactic in the post-pandemic era, the researchers concluded. Mask wearing is definitely down from where it was at the beginning of the pandemic. An Ipsos poll from last fall showed that only 37% of people surveyed admitted to wearing masks regularly. While learning more about the ineffectiveness of masks in terms of preventing the spread of COVID and other similar diseases, brand new research from the Cochrane Institute shows that surgical masks decrease the chance of catching COVID or another flu-like disease by only 5%. Yet, we see people continue to wear a mask, although less often than we used to. Perhaps mask wearing is rooted in issues of attractiveness and self-worth, as this study suggests, or maybe masks are serving as more of a psychological barrier than a viral one. Here's the deal for those still insisting on wearing masks on planes or anywhere else. Put your mask on, pull it down, and take a drag of a cigarette. Pull it back up and let it out. See the smoke shoot out the side? That's you forcing your germs onto the person in the seat next to you. Knock it off. That was me, by the way. Oh, wait a minute. Right back in May 2020, California Governor Newsom, billion-dollar mask deal. California government governor and presidential candidate Gavin Newsom announced the deal to great fanfare, calling it a bold and big effort in the state's fight against the coronavirus. He said the deal would result in 500 million masks that were a mixture of traditional surgical masks and the more protective N95 models to the state over the next 2.5 months. The state took the unusual step of paying about half the contract up front to cover about 30 million N95 masks at $3.30 per mask. Amazon has them today for 40 cents each. Oops. The payment was made to Global Healthcare Product Solutions, a subsidiary of BYD, owned by Warren Buffett, by the way. And the same month, Newsom appealed directly to investor Warren Buffett to support demolishing 4 hydroelectric dams in a river along the Oregon-California border to save salmon populations. The price per mask was first reported Wednesday by Los Angeles Times, and based on purchasing documents from the state treasurer's office, the total contract also included looser-fitting surgical masks, though details on those were not part of the initial payment, said Brian Ferguson, a spokesman for the Office of Emergency Services. Tens of millions of surgical masks have already arrived, but the N95 masks were delayed, Newsom said. Last week, the state paid an additional $104.7 million for those first shipments. Newsom said last month that the state and federal government had teams on the ground in China auditing and visiting BYD's factory. We are looking to make sure we do not procure what is not authorized and ultimately is not validated, he said. Got to move that inventory, baby. Coffee is for closers, even at a 90% loss to taxpayers. But the salmon will be back. Always follow the money. Unbelievable. Typical, but unbelievable. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. Welcome to my thought of the week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thank you for doing it. No greater nor more affectionate honor can be conferred on an American than to have a public school named after him, Herbert Hoover. During my time as a state legislator, I've pushed for significant investment in public school districts. In Congress, I would look forward to increasing federal public investment in education through initiatives like Race to the Top. Also, in Congress, I will work hard to encourage investment in education, particularly with respect to technology and bridging the digital divide. Hakeem Jeffries, who made history as the first Black lawmaker to lead a party in Congress. The New York Democrat now leads the minority party in the U.S. House of Representatives, succeeding Rep. Nancy Pelosi out of students, according to the New York State report card. In New York, 38% of fifth graders are proficient, 12% of migrants, 18% of students with disabilities. Oh, goody. Maybe more of his investments in tech will help. Here's a good one. The problem with public schools is not overcrowding in the classroom. The problem is not teacher unions. The problem is not underfunding or lack of computer equipment. The problem is your damn kids, PJ O'Rourke. Maybe, or maybe it's politics. There is no school equal to a decent home and no teacher equal to a virtuous parent. Mahatma Gandhi. That's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, Alex Nestor, for caring so deeply about our school-age kids. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper. Peace in our time.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.